Ohio voters will see a constitutional amendment on the November ballot seeking to change the state's redistricting process yet again. But the ballot language might not reflect what supporters of the amendment say are the measure's intentions. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today, we'll talk about why the amendment backers are now threatening court action. We'll also hear how Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost has gotten involved in the Kroger-Albertsons merger, and we'll discuss why Metro is thinking of moving its transit hub from Government Square in downtown Cincinnati. Here to get our Friday news review started is Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Media Statehouse News Bureau, Karen Kassler. Welcome back, Karen.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Doing fantastic.
You are busy, I know, because even as we're talking, the ballot board is meeting. We've talked before on this program about issue one that will be on the November ballot in Ohio. Remind us again, just briefly, what this would change about the state's redistricting process if voters approve it.
Well, right now, lines for state lawmakers and congressional lawmakers are drawn and approved by the Ohio Redistricting Commission, which is a 7-member panel of elected people, the governor, the auditor, the secretary of state, and two each of the House and the Senate from both parties. And they approve the maps, or in some cases, draw the maps. And the maps that they drew last time, which was the first time the Ohio Redistricting Commission was in effect in 2021, those maps 7 times went before the Ohio Supreme Court and were ruled unconstitutionally gerrymandered. So this group, Citizens Not Politicians, proposed an amendment that would change that process again and would make it so that lines would be drawn by a 15-member panel of people who are not politicians, 5 independents, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, selected by retired judges. And the selection process is very complicated. I've really trimmed it down a lot, but that's the essence of it.
We appreciate the Cliff's Notes version. We do. So supporters of this change, this group, Citizens Not Politicians, collected more than enough signatures to get on the ballot. The next step is determining what language voters will see on the ballot. And that's it. That's what the ballot board is talking about today, right?
Yes. And what happens here is the ballot board approves that language that the voters will see. And the language that the group Citizens Not Politicians put forward is on the table, as well as draft language from Republican Secretary of State Frank LaRose's office. And again, LaRose does sit on the Ohio Redistricting Commission. His office proposed language compared to the Citizens Not Politicians, which is 5 bullet points. It's kind of a little bit longer than maybe a paragraph. The language from the Secretary of State's office is 3 pages. And the language is entirely different. Now the folks are at the panel are arguing about whether the 5 bullet points proposed by the backers of the amendment would be enough to explain this amendment, which is fairly long and, like I said, complicated. But the backers of the amendment are saying the language from the Secretary of State's office is incredibly biased, and it's intending to manipulate voters into voting no for this.
3 pages would be a lot to read on a ballot while you're voting, wouldn't it? I mean, that seems pretty cumbersome.
Absolutely. And for a long time, we were hearing about time limits in the voting booth and that you needed to be out in a certain time frame. And so, yeah, 3 pages is a lot to read, especially if you're not familiar with what this issue does. And a lot of people are going to be voting in this election because we've got a presidential race, a U.S. Senate race, people who aren't necessarily as in tune with politics as folks who are listening right now might be. And so this may be the first time that they'll be confronted with this issue. So the language, the ballot language, is incredibly important.
Well, and I could be wrong about this, but isn't kind of the common wisdom that if a voter doesn't understand something like this, they typically vote no?
Yes. And I think that that's pretty understandable. When you're confused about something, you don't want to change something, especially something that would go into the Ohio Constitution. So, yeah, the idea would be that if I don't understand it, maybe this is not something for me. And the language here, when you start comparing the language between these two proposals, I mean, the language from the Secretary of State's office starts out with that issue one would create an appointed redistricting commission not elected by or subject to removal by the voters of the state. And the first thing that you see below that is that the amendment would repeal constitutional protections against gerrymandering, approved by nearly three quarters of Ohio electors participating in the statewide elections of 2015 and 2018, and eliminate the longstanding ability of Ohio citizens to hold their representatives accountable for establishing fair state legislative and congressional districts. So it sounds really, really bad. It is true that the Citizens Not Politicians Amendment would change the process entirely, but this language they're calling very, very misleading.
What can this group, the Citizens Not Politicians group, do about what they consider to be misleading language? Can they take legal action?
Well, right now, the hearing room where the ballot board is meeting is full of activists with Citizens Not Politicians. They packed the room. There's a lot of concern about this because this is a group that worked very hard to get this issue before voters in November after their frustration over the redistricting process last time around. So they're making their arguments right now. They've got a lawyer who's making arguments before the ballot board right now. If indeed the ballot board does go ahead and approve the Secretary of State's office language, which seems likely because the ballot board is three Republicans and two Democrats, then there would be a lawsuit. And retired Republican Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor, who's been working with the Citizens Not Politicians group, in fact, she helped write that amendment, she's already threatening to lead the lawsuit, which would go to the Ohio Supreme Court.
Has the ballot board been accused of manipulating ballot language before?
Well, yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, last year, with both the August amendment that would have required 60% voter approval to change the Constitution, and then especially with the November issue one amendment that would put reproductive rights into Ohio's Constitution, that language got them sued especially. I mean, both those issues, there were lawsuits. But it was the reproductive rights amendment language that really concerned the backers of that, because there were things that were left out, words that were changed. For instance, the word fetus, which is in the amendment, was changed to unborn child in the ballot language summary. And in the end, the language stood. Voters approved the amendment anyway. And so that's going to be something that I think supporters of this amendment are going to be looking at if they indeed fail before the ballot board and then fail before the Ohio Supreme Court.
And we're talking right now, it's not quite 12:15 and the ballot board's still meeting, so you're still waiting to see what the vote will be, I guess.
Yeah, my State House News Bureau colleague Joe Ingles is there following this case, and it's been very interesting, too, because Secretary of State Frank LaRose had said he was not going to be the chair of this ballot board meeting because he was on military duty out of state, and he is here. He is at the meeting. He got a three-day pass, and so he is here to chair this meeting.
Interesting. Well, speaking of the Ohio Secretary of State, he this week said he suspects some of the people who are circulating voter petitions for this fall's ballot might be guilty of election law violations. Are there specific campaigns that he's raising questions about?
Well, he's saying that it was these canvassers who were working with a specific group that was circulating petitions for that Citizens Not Politicians amendment, but also doing some voter registration. He said some of those canvassers, he thinks, broke the law and did so deliberately. And so he's asked prosecutors in 20 counties to look over what he's alleging and decide whether they want to go ahead and file charges. But it's not the company, he said, it's the actual canvassers. He feels that there was a pattern of fraudulent signings and activities that they were doing that he said led him to believe that signatures were being forged. And, you know, that's obviously a problem.
Yeah. And he sent referrals for violations to prosecutors, didn't he?
Yeah. And that's the real question here, is whether there will be prosecutions, because we hear quite often with voter fraud, for instance, voter fraud is very rare. And even LaRose's office will testify to that. But when there are instances of voter fraud, sometimes they are turned over to county prosecutors. The question is whether county prosecutors think there's enough intentional wrongdoing to go ahead and file charges. And that's even rarer when prosecutors go ahead and take action. So this will be something to follow up on.
Is there any risk that this could keep any issues or candidates off the ballot?
No, there's no question that the Citizens Not Politicians group had plenty of signatures, and none of the signatures that they gathered are in question here. So there's no chance that this would be something that could keep that amendment off the fall ballot.
As I understand it, it was Secretary of State LaRosa's Election Integrity Unit that found these problems. How long has that Election Integrity Unit been around?
That's been around for about 2 years. And again, it's one of those things that, you know, he's admitted that voter fraud is rare. In fact, Secretaries of State going back decades have said voter fraud is rare. But the Election Integrity Unit was created to battle back against any sort of election wrongdoing. And I think, you know, it's a notable addition to his office in that we are in a period where you have people who have accused elections officials in other states of all sorts of terrible things, many of them completely unsubstantiated. So this is an interesting unit to have around. And one of the things that I think is important to watch here, too, is that LaRose removed Ohio from an election a voter registration database that many, many other states were using because of concerns from Republican activists. And I'm wondering if this group is going to get involved in any sort of verifying of voter registrations after that.
Mm. And interesting, just to clarify, he pulled out of this Electronic Registration Information Center because of those concerns of Republican activists that I just, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because I had asked him about ERIC, as it was known, and he had called it one of the best fraud fighting tools that we have. And then a month later, he and several other Republican states pulled out of ERIC, saying that they were concerned about some of the activities and how voter registration data was being shared and that Democrats were somehow using it to register more Democrats than Republicans.
Okay, well, let's turn now to another legal issue, and that is what's happening in this Hamilton County Common Pleas Court. A judge there was expected to issue a ruling this week on whether Ohio's 6-week abortion ban could move forward, but that didn't happen. Tell us what happened.
Well, this is the third time there's been a delay on a decision on the constitutionality of Ohio's 6-week abortion ban, which some people have called the heartbeat ban. And this is a ban that says a woman can't have an abortion after a fetal heartbeat is detected, and there are no exceptions in that law for rape, incest, or life of the woman. And this law went into effect right after the Dobbs decision from the U.S. Supreme Court that overturned the federal right to abortion. And so doctors had sued saying this was a problem, their patients were endangered, and on other legal grounds. Well, then again, Ohioans voted for a reproductive rights amendment in November. And so the legality of this 6-week ban under Ohio's new constitutional amendment has been litigated in this courtroom now for several months, and we're still waiting for the judge to deliver a decision.
And this lawsuit, it was filed shortly after the 6-week ban went into effect, right? Not long after the U.S. Supreme Court decision that overturned Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, exactly. The doctors then filed the suit. The state has said that these doctors didn't have standing to do that. And then after the issue one vote in November and voters approved this reproductive rights amendment, the case was essentially reopened when the Ohio Supreme Court sent it back to Hamilton County and said Hamilton County gets to decide whether this 6-week ban is constitutional under that new amendment. And that's pardon me. Someone's trying to reach me. But the question, of course, becomes if indeed the reproductive rights amendment was approved, well, how can a 6-week ban on abortion be constitutional under that? And obviously, the state has argued that there are parts of that ban that should still stay in effect. But it's interesting to note that Republican Attorney General Dave Yost, in his opposition to issue one last year, said if issue one passes, then that 6-week ban would not exist.
Huh. Now, the court, shortly after that lawsuit was filed, the court granted an injunction. My understanding is that means the 6-week ban hasn't been enforced since that injunction, right?
Yes. Okay. And we're still waiting to find out what's going to happen with that. But this is going to be the progress of all abortion-related legislation in Ohio after the approval of that reproductive rights amendment. Legislators have made no moves. Republican legislators have made no moves to change any existing abortion-related law, instead just relying on the courts to decide.
Okay. Well, Karen, thank you so much. You are clearly busy with phones ringing and ballot boards meeting and all kinds of stuff going on. I've been talking to Bureau Chief of the Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau, Karen Kassler. Thank you so much for your time today.
Hey, great to talk to you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost is weighing in this week on the Kroger-Albertsons merger. That's next when Cincinnati Edition returns. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Attorneys general across the U.S. have weighed in on the Kroger Company's bid to acquire the Albertsons grocery chain, some in favor of the deal and some opposed. Now, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost has added his voice to the mix. Joining me now to talk about where he stands is WVXU 9 I-Team reporter Dan Monk. Welcome back, Dan.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And I should clarify, we're going to talk about where Dave Yost stands on this merger, not where you stand on the merger. You don't have to tell me that. You're a reporter. So
I don't and I won't.
Good. Good for you. Stand firm. We've talked with you before about Kroger's proposed acquisition of Albertsons. Remind us how big this deal is.
$24.6 billion. It's the biggest acquisition in Kroger's history, and it would result in a company that has about 5,000 stores minus 637, I think, is the number that Kroger says it will divest if the deal receives clearance. So it's a big merger. It would make Kroger, the biggest supermarket chain in the country, and improve their ability to compete against bigger companies like Walmart and Amazon and Costco.
And as I mentioned, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost weighed in on the deal this week. What did he say? Where does he stand on this?
He says the FTC has a simplistic view of the nation's grocery market. One of the big issues in this case, which is coming to a three-week hearing that starts next week, one of the big issues in this case is going to be, what is the relevant market for determining whether the merger will cause competitive problems or violate antitrust rules? The companies argue the market is bigger than what the FTC suggests. The FTC says it's supermarkets only, and Dave Yost lines up with the companies on that issue. He says Kroger obviously competes against companies like Walmart and Amazon and Costco and Aldi. And so to just compare supermarkets, he says, doesn't give you a full view of the competitive landscape. And he thinks the merger should be allowed to go forward on that basis alone.
Well, I mentioned that a number of attorneys general across the country have taken positions on this, but they're not all on the same side Dave Yost is, right?
Right. Yost aligns with the attorney general of Idaho, which is where Albertsons is based, and then also with Alabama and Georgia, which are two states that have a fairly limited impact from this. You know, Kroger is buying Albertsons stores in towns where it doesn't directly compete against them. And Alabama is one example of a state where there's very little crossover between the two. So you've got those attorneys general on one side, and then attorneys general from seven states who've lined up with the FTC and actually joined their complaint to block the merger.
Well, Attorney General Yost is a Republican, but a couple of prominent Ohio Democrats have endorsed the merger too, right?
That's right. Senator Sherrod Brown and Congressman Landsman have both endorsed the idea. They like the fact that Kroger is a union company, and they tout the deal's ability to preserve union jobs.
You kind of described the legal argument that Dave Yost makes in his brief. Has the FTC responded to that argument in different forums?
Yeah, they didn't in the federal case. But they did have an argument that is contrary to what Yost is saying in a July 31st filing with the Federal Trade Commission. So their legal team described analysis that was conducted by one of their expert witnesses, somebody who's likely to testify in this federal case. And it basically compared the impact of Kroger's merger and the competitive impact of it on supermarkets, and then the broader market, which they describe as large format stores. So if you look just at supermarkets, this expert, Dr. Nicholas Hill, found that merger is presumptively illegal in 1,928 markets, while if you look at the larger universe of companies in the large format segment, there are 1,785 markets that would be negatively impacted by the merger. So FTC's argument is, even if you go with Kroger's definition of all large format stores are part of this relevant market, Dr. Hill's analysis shows that the merger still causes competitive harm.
What kind of impact could this deal have locally in Greater Cincinnati? This is, you know, this does have national implications, as you've talked about. Mm-hmm. What would it mean for us here in the tri-state?
It would have very little impact on sort of the competitive landscape, because Albertsons doesn't have any stores here. But it probably would have a big impact on Cincinnati, just in terms of the strength of Kroger. It's one of our largest companies. It would probably add jobs if it's a bigger company, and arguably it would be more profitable, and that would be good for Greater Cincinnati.
What's next with this whole deal? This has been something that these two companies have been working on for some time, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the big showdown is next week, and that's the 3-week hearing that federal judge Adrian Nelson has scheduled to determine whether this merger violates antitrust rules. And so you'll see experts like Dr. Hill testifying for the FTC, and Kroger will put on their own experts. And I think they'll get into three major issues. One is this, relevant market debate, whether supermarkets or a broader look at retail grocery should be the relevant market you analyze. And then the other question is whether the merger will have an anti-competitive effect on labor. And that's a relatively new argument that the FTC has made successfully in book publishing deals. Now they're trying to apply it to the grocery industry. And then finally, the judge will have to analyze whether Kroger's divestiture plan will eliminate any of the harm that the FTC will happen if the merger goes through. So if Kroger's able to unload these roughly 600 stores to CNS wholesale grocers, will that mute the anti-competitive impacts that the FTC will be in place if the merger happens?
You going to be flying to Oregon for the case?
I'd like to, but I'm not.
Yeah.
There's a possibility that they're going to have it on via Zoom or audio versions that will be streaming. So I hope to cover the trial, daily.
Well, good. We hope you cover it, too, because then we get to talk to you about it.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Well, I want to move to another issue you've been covering, and that is this Future of Gaming Study Commission Ohio had that looked at a number of possible changes to the state's sports betting landscape. Mm-hmm. Some of the lawmakers who served on that commission want to see a change related to bets on individual college athletes. Can you explain what the law is now and what change these lawmakers want to see?
Well, there was a new rule that the Ohio Casino Control Commission passed back in February that said you cannot place prop bets, which are bets on the individual performance of an athlete in collegiate sports. You can still place prop bets on professional athletes, but not on college athletes. And the reason they did that was the NCAA presented evidence that players are being harassed by fans and or gamblers, either on social media or in person. And they're being harassed because, if their performance doesn't measure up to the way you bet, then you're angry because you lost money. And so they gathered some evidence from the NCAA. The director of the Casino Control Commission, Matt Schuler, said he talked to a lot of college athletic directors. And he came away convinced that prop bets needed to be limited for college athletes, or restricted, banned.
Sure. Yeah. So these three lawmakers want to see that change. Why do they argue that would be a good thing?
They said that the that because of NIL, which is name, image, and likeness, the ability for college athletes now to make money on their name, image, and likeness, sponsorship deals, and promotional arrangements. Because they now receive NIL money, they're just like pros. And so they shouldn't have the protection. The rules should be the same for them because they're behaving just like pros. That's what their argument was in a letter to the Future of Gaming Commission.
Is that something the Ohio Casino Control Commission is considering?
Doesn't look like it. They say there's no plan to review or reconsider their rule, and there really is no mechanism for the state legislature to force them to do so. In fact, they changed the rule under a mechanism that was established by the Ohio legislature, which is any sports governing body can propose a new rule, and if there's evidence to back that up, the commission can adopt a new rule, and that's what they did in this case.
The expansion of legalized gambling, sports gambling in Ohio is still pretty new. Remind us of the history a little bit.
Well, it's the last year was when sports betting started, January of 2023, and that was the first major expansion of gambling in Ohio since casinos were allowed in 2013, I believe it was. So, I think this was an industry that generated something like $7 billion in total bets in its first year. And so it was a major expansion of gambling in Ohio. And I think state lawmakers wanted to kind of regroup and figure out how that's going, as well as explore new ideas for whether gambling should be, further expanded in Ohio. And at the same time, the Casino Control Commission is doing its own review of this. Where do we stand with gambling? And both of these things are kind of percolating, but there are no ideas that have really gained a lot of traction, with the exception of a study that the Ohio Casino Control Commission is now pursuing with a UK-based behavioral insights team.
I'll let you get a drink of water. Yeah. Catch yourself there. I do want to talk to you about that, but first, let me ask you: there were several other new ideas the commission looked at, and I'm talking about here the Future of Gaming Study Commission. One of them was iGaming. Talk to us about iGaming. I didn't even know that was a thing before I read your story.
iGaming is having a casino on your phone, just like having, a sports book on your phone with sports betting. And so the commission heard testimony from people who want to offer this gambling activity in Ohio. And what they learned was that surrounding states have adopted this and are generating hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue for the state. And more than $1.7 billion in bets a year. And so a lot of the concerns that were raised in this Future of Gaming hearing came from existing casinos who fear that when people can gamble on their phones, they won't come to a casino to gamble. And also the Ohio Lottery said its keno sales are down 7% due to sports betting. And so it's also concerned that if online gambling is expanded in Ohio, its form of gambling will go by the wayside.
Interesting. There were also some suggestions, new suggestions related to brick and mortar sports books. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through those?
Yeah, it's a similar kind of issue because people prefer to gamble on their phones. There's a state senator who thinks that Ohio's tax rate for sports books should be reduced from 20% down to 10% for retail sports books, because they're having trouble attracting people to make bets in their brick and mortar facilities because most people want to bet on the phone. And so when Ohio increased the tax rate for sports books, they increased it both for online competitors and for sports books. And now there's a state senator, Nathan Manning, who wants to wants to reduce the rate for brick and mortar to give them some kind of competitive advantage, you know, against the online sports books like DraftKings and, you know, excuse me.
No problem. Well, and it sounds to me like he's kind of arguing, and Dan, I'm not sure where you are, but I hope somebody can bring you a drink of water or something. I feel like I'm tormenting you. But it sounds like this lawmaker says, hey, we need to give the brick and mortar sports books a little bit of an edge because of employment. Is that kind of where he's coming from?
Yeah, these are companies that do employ people, and there's an incentive in the state to have people actually operating businesses. So,
okay. And I don't know if you feel like you can, but if you can, I do want to circle back to these new responsible gaming tools that the Ohio Casino Control Commission is working on. You mentioned this consulting company, I think, from the UK. Are you able to tell us a little bit more about that?
I don't know. We'll see. what they're looking at are these. If you've ever bet on a sports betting app, there's this little button that says RG. It stands for responsible gaming, and Ohioans have the ability to limit the amount of time and money that they spend on sports betting apps. But the problem is, according to Matt Schuler, the executive director of the Casino Control Commission, only about 2% of those that use the app use those tools. And so they're trying to figure out how to get people to adopt, I guess, more healthy behaviors instead of, being online all the time and being subject to promotional offers that come through. And what they did was they hired a behavioral health expert to analyze how people are interacting with these tools, and they're going to make some recommendations on how they can get bettors to behave more responsibly.
Mm-hmm. And does it sound like they're going to get a report on these new tools anytime soon? And does it sound like there could be an expansion of sports betting anytime soon?
Yes to the former and no to the latter. I don't think expansion will happen anytime
okay.
in the next year. I think people we continue to need to digest the gambling that's already available.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll let and you stop the, there, Dan. I feel like I've tormented you enough.
The behavioral health team is going to release a report this fall, and that should lead to some final recommendations sometime early next year.
Okay. Well, Dan, thank you for powering through with us. I've been talking with WCPO9 iTeam reporter Dan Monk. Thanks so much for your time today, Dan. Okay, so, sorry, Dan. Up next, Metro is thinking about moving its downtown transit hub. We're going to hear why, and I want to let you know that next week we're going to begin some election coverage on Cincinnati Edition. We'll be talking about whether vice presidential running mates matter. We're also going to discuss Project 2025 as part of our coverage as the DNC is happening. We're going to talk about Metro next. We'll hear why they're thinking about moving. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Metro might be moving its downtown Cincinnati transit hub, and a UC ornithologist is training the next generation to help track the declining bird population. Joining me now for the buses and birds portion of today's news review are WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner. Thanks for being here, Tana.
My pleasure, Lucy.
And for the first time on Cincinnati Edition, WVXU environment reporter Isabel Nisley. Welcome, Isabel.
Thank you, Lucy.
So good to have you here. We're going to start with you, Tana. Metro is looking at other possible locations for its downtown hub, which is now at Government Square. Where might the hub move?
Well, that's the question, right? So they are looking for a consultant to sort of analyze the various options. The big one that I think most people are interested to hear about would, of course, be the Riverfront Transit Center, which is below 2nd Street, right kind of by the banks.
And what prompted this idea to maybe move the hub?
So they were getting ready to update Government Square, their Government Square transit hub that you referenced. And that is part of issue 7 that voters passed in 2020. You probably more know it better as Reinventing Metro. So as part of Reinventing Metro, they said Government Square needed a facelift. It needed some renovations. It needed some amenity improvements to make it more user-friendly, make it a little bit more modern. And then along with that, they're also going to build out a storefront across the street from Government Square in, I believe, the Mercantile Building to have, you know, a customer-facing point-of-sale location help, kind of like a storefront, really. So that was all part of the plan. And then they were getting ready to sort of start that work, and they heard from stakeholders that said, wait, 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 you know, is Government Square really the best place to have the downtown transit hub?
Interesting. Well, tell us more about the Riverfront Transit Center. That's been around for a while, hasn't it?
So it was built in, well, it opened in 2003. It cost $18 million to build, and it was constructed as part of the Fort Washington Way reconstruction, which folks may or may not remember, I guess, depending.
I remember. I covered that so long, but please go ahead.
I was in Oxford at the time. I was still at WMUB. But so it's an underground bus station, basically, below 2nd Street. And it gets used for big events. A lot of people like to say it doesn't get used at all. It did host very famously a big, I think it was like an EDM concert or some sort of music concert. And but it does, a lot of people say it doesn't get used. It does get used for big events like Blink. They use it a lot. And for charter buses, use it a lot during Reds and Bengals games and other big events like that. But it doesn't get used regularly, like day to day, as what we might think of as a bus station. So, you know, folks have said, you know, when Metro was thinking about starting these renovations, well, why not use, make better use, in their words, of the Riverfront Transit Center?
I know I've walked through it during like 5Ks and stuff like that. It's real handy if it's raining outside. So there's another use for it.
I'm not sure I've ever been in it, Lucy.
Really?
It is. I'm not sure.
I don't know if this is appropriate to say on the radio, but I'm going for it. It would be a great setting for a zombie apocalypse movie. I don't know. Maybe somebody's already thinking about that. But if it doesn't get used more. Yeah. Oh, yeah. There we go. I hope she's listening. Yeah, there you go. So you mentioned before that stakeholders were the ones who said, yo, wait a minute, is Government Square really the place to do this? Who's going to get a say, or who's going to be consulted when they hire this firm or whoever it is to decide if the hub should move?
So they have an RFP out right now, their request for proposals for a consultant to come in and look at all the options. I mean, the Riverfront Transit Center is the big one that's being bandied about, but there are some other thoughts, like across 5th Street, I believe, where there's also another little smaller bus station, or some other potentials that, you know, people haven't maybe thought of yet, or other places where it could maybe be built. And then they just kind of keep saying it's stakeholders who will make the decision. So obviously the folks at SORTA, which is the governing body that oversees Metro, businesses in the area, maybe the employees, they've got kind of a whole list of stakeholders. Presumably it would also include riders, you know, community members, employees, as they go through the process.
How many people use Government Square typically?
Yeah, Metro, it's kind of hard to judge people, you know, because it's a hub and spoke system, right? So people maybe come into the city and then go out of the city. But Metro says on average, there are 11,000 to 12,000 boardings that take place daily at Government Square. So it's a good chunk of people, like nearly most people go through it that ride Metro.
Yeah. Does Metro have a deadline for making this decision, or any kind of time frame that they told you about?
Well, the deadline for the RFPs for people who want to be considered for the consultant is August 20th. There's not a deadline beyond that, so we don't know. Now, there also wasn't a deadline yet to start the renovation on Government Square, because that had not gone out for bid. So we're not super, you know, too far down the path of one and just all of a sudden making like a sharp U-turn or anything. As well. So that no budgeting had been allocated for that either. And again, all of this comes out of issue 7, the Reinventing Metro, that taxpayers voted for.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, speaking of sharp turns, I'm going to transition very smoothly to talking about birds now. Isabel, I'm so excited to have you on the show for the first time since you started at WVXU. So thank you for being here.
Of course, I'm so excited for my first time to be on the show.
Yay. Well, I won't be mean to you, I promise. You spent time recently with bird banders. So I want to know, what is a bird bander? What do they do? Why are they banding birds?
Yeah, so bird banding is this research technique that allows scientists to study the whole population without having to track every single bird, right? And this is important because bird banders have been able to tell us that bird populations have been shrinking for decades, which isn't only bad for birds, but their decline kind of tells us that other environmental components are struggling as well. They eat insects and they depend on habitat. But bird banding also has some very positive uses. This UC professor that I went out to meet in Harrison, his research on birds, is used to develop conservation strategies. So the data he collects is submitted to the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, and they're able to do things like protect and manage the land that they have to better serve birds.
Yeah. Well, and you talked to this UC ornithologist. How long has he been doing this work, and how many birds has he documented over the years?
Yeah, Professor Canterbury has really dedicated his entire life, his entire career to birds. He's been banding birds for 35 years and has banded more than 80,000 of them. And he puts it pretty simply. He's like, my purpose of my research is to save the birds. And while he's certainly not done doing it, he is looking to the next generation to kind of continue his work. And maybe the next bird bander who's going to work for 35 years and band 80,000 birds is in this cohort of students he's working with.
Wow, 35 years and 80,000 birds. And obviously he can't do this forever. Talk about what he's doing to train this next generation.
Yeah, so like I said, he has this kind of research station out in Harrison. And this isn't for a class necessarily, but he invites students, people who are interested, to come work with him and kind of see as he wakes up at 3 a.m. and sets up these big, long nets as the sun is rising and removes birds from them, identifies them, takes down data, weighs them. They're all by his side and often doing the work as he's doing it as well. And though it can take years to become a certified bird bander, obviously, to keep the birds safe and the research good, he's kind of providing students with the first step of getting that hands-on experience with birds and doing this research with them.
Wow, out there before the sun rises. So he needs early birds to help him with this bird banding, it sounds like.
He might even be the early bird, who knows?
That's right. But he's catching birds, not worms, so good for him.
Exactly. The early bird bander catches the bird, yeah. That's what they say.
So describe what you saw. You were out there real early on the morning that you spent time with this professor and these people. Kind of paint a picture for us.
Yeah, so I was at the UC Center for Field Studies, which has kind of a barn I see as I drive up. And I think the most shocking thing that I first saw was the birds chirping. And I walk up and there's this group of college students who are awake at 7 a.m. on a Saturday. So these people are serious about what they're doing.
Maybe they never went to bed.
Maybe they never went to bed. Canterbury had his truck kind of pulled up to the prairie, and the back is open and it's filled with all of these mostly bands. They're these small aluminum bands that they clasp onto the birds to track them. And they come in all different sizes. So lots of bands. There's a scale, paper bags, things like that. And the students kind of start there and they trek a couple feet to this large prairie. And there are these nets kind of spread out across the prairie, which are used to catch the birds. And as the students are walking along the prairie, they're looking in the nets and seeing things like cicadas being caught in them, which wasn't the purpose, but they're also finding birds, which they're able to safely extract, kind of hold them, admire them, and then take them back to the research station to do that collection of data.
Yeah, so these nets don't hurt the birds. The banding doesn't hurt the birds.
No.
They're all about, they're the friends of the birds.
Certainly, they want to save the birds, yeah. Right? It's a safe research method.
Yeah. Why are they all so committed to this work?
Yeah, a lot of them have just kind of found their passion with the birds. And many of this say that's because of Canterbury's passion, right? They see what he's doing. They see the care he has for the environment. He sees that he wants them to have a future that's filled with birdsong and like a healthy place to live. And they're willing to take on that work to continue what he's doing. They see the value of the birds in the environment and the environment as a whole, and they're wanting to take steps to keep it safe and viable for their generation, the generation after that.
You mentioned that the bird population has been declining for decades. That's a concern for many, many reasons. How do the people who are doing this work stay motivated? I mean, that's got to be kind of depressing if they go out there and they see a lot fewer birds in these nets than they have in previous years. How do they stay motivated?
Yeah, certainly. That's a great observation. And when I was there, they had only caught 9 birds by mid-morning. And everyone was saying, this is pretty unusual. It's a pretty stark decline. Canterbury said, when I kind of started off 35 years ago, we were catching 35, 40 birds in a morning like this. And to see 9 is a pretty stark difference. But people said, well, that can be alarming. Also, doing the act of bird banding feels like they're making a difference. And being surrounded by these people who want to wake up at 7 a.m. with them and to track these birds and collect data on them is a motivator for them to continue doing the work that will hopefully save the birds.
Yeah. Well, you've been reporting on the environment for WVXU now for a little while. This is a new focus for the station, so very excited and very glad to have you here. What are the top environmental issues facing our region that you've kind of found in your reporting so far?
Yeah, climate change is simply the largest environmental issue that's facing our region, but people who I've interviewed have all experienced different environmental effects of that. Like Canterbury, you know, he's worried about the shrinking wildlife populations, or Hamilton County Emergency Services is saying summers are getting dangerously hot, which is something we've all felt. The city of Cincinnati worries about pollution and litter and what's that doing to our health. And while there's certainly meaningful action being taken on this, many of the sources that I've talked to have said that there's not enough being done. So while climate change is certainly creating these environmental issues, a lack of action, whether it's from normal people and doing things simple like recycling or governments investing money into initiatives, just the not enough action is continuing or causing these issues to get worse.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate that you are here to shine a light on all that. I've been talking with WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner and WVXU environment reporter Isabel Nisley. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director today is Ella Rowan. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.